This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Youthful Energy, providing you with a unique energy support of pure NT Factor. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause. Age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years. With a 45-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoff, and we're talking about the science behind our relationship with food with Dr. Rachel Hertz. She's a neuroscientist, and she teaches at Brown University and Boston College, author of a new book, Why You Eat What You Eat. And in your book, Dr. Hertz, you state something which I didn't know, quite fascinating. Quote, "We experience the most exquisite flavor perception of any creature on Earth." Why is that?
So that's because we have an open airway passage between our nose and our throat, which potentially most people can know if they've ever been having something in their mouth and they've laughed so hard that maybe it came out their nose.
Yeah.
Or if you're talking and eating and all of a sudden you start choking, They realize that the airway flow and the swallowing down to your stomach flow is all interconnected. And so this does run the risk of choking hazard. So that is real, and why people do choke to death is because of the fact that they're swallowing, they're inhaling food directly into their lungs. But this seems to have been an evolutionarily beneficial development for humans to be able to develop language, spoken language.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of why it exists as kind of a biological sort of selection pressure. But it also is the case, and this could also be very much selected for biologically, that being able to breathe while we eat, and especially the exhalation of the experience of something in our mouth. So we're inhaling and we're exhaling and we're chewing at the same time. That exhalation in particular is what is allowing what is in our mouth from the point of view of the aroma molecules to be able to travel up to the nose, so that you're experiencing this fusion of the taste, so let's say salty, and that aroma of bacon at the same time. And it feels like it's all coming from your mouth, but it's actually coming from your nose and your mouth together. And that ability to have that breathing cycle go on while we're chewing gives us this experience of flavor. Now, dogs, for instance, who have fantastic sense of smell, and other animals that have a fantastic sense of smell, do not have that, you know, opening. Mm. So they can taste the food and they can sniff it from the outside, but while they're eating it, and often if you watch a dog, they're not really spending a lot of time chewing. They're
like
inhaling.
Gulping,
but
yeah.
They're not getting that pleasure in their mouth that we get from that fusion of taste and aroma.
What this isn't this a setup for a gluttony? You know, because it's so pleasurable, it lights up so many of our senses, maybe more so than any creatures in the animal kingdom.
Yes, but it also means that if you slow down, so for example, if you savor the flavor and you keep, let's say, that chocolate melting in your mouth and breathing over it, you're going to get more from that than if you just, you know, inhale, swallow, repeat kind of thing. So this is actually also a way that people can think about maximizing and drawing out the pleasure of eating and not eating so much. Because if you keep what you have in your mouth for longer, you chew longer, you savor it longer, you let it melt for longer and so forth, you're going to get more from that, from the aroma and flavor. And that actually can potentially make you eat less.
And that actually is borne out by the study of people with a condition called anosmia, which they have the taste, the sensation of taste, but they've lost the sensation of smell, and that can occur due to nerve damage to the olfactory nerves, some viral diseases, but also sometimes physical accidents damage the sense of smell, and people lose that. And, of course, that's a miserable condition, and it's a dangerous condition because you can't smell danger. You can't smell gas in your apartment. But also, you know, you lose pleasure with eating. But paradoxically, and this is counterintuitive, those people gain weight, according to your book.
Yeah, so the studies that have followed people over time who've lost their sense of smell see that, generally speaking, there's a gain in weight over time rather than loss. Hmm. Although initially there tends to be some yo-yoing because people are kind of desperately in search of that deliciousness that they used to experience with eating something. Mm-hmm. And then they'll try it, eat it a lot, and so they may gain weight temporarily. And then they realize that food is just so unrewarding that they may eat a lot less for a period of time. But what usually happens is they settle down into eating more. And the reason why, specifically from the point of view of more in terms of calories, fats and sugars and salt are things that they can still perceive. So those foods, fried foods, donuts, you know, all those kinds of things that give the fat and the carbohydrate and the sweet and the salty tend to be very high in calories. And those are the things they can still experience in terms of pleasure. And so they tend to eat foods which are more calorie dense, potentially also less nutritious overall. And so there tends to be a steady weight gain. And, you know, this is because food is, you know, amongst the most pleasurable things that we can experience. And if you can't get any of that flavor pleasure, then getting those sort of sensations of fat and sweet and so forth tends to be what you go for.
I guess it's sort of like, you know, when you're given ultra filtered cigarettes, you just end up smoking more, you know, to you know, suck down the nicotine and get the gratification.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Similar to that. Are some foods more satiating than others? What do the studies say?
So that's a fantastic question, and it's, shockingly enough, not very well answered at all. And you would think that this would be something that nutritionists and food psychologists and other people would spend a lot of time trying to figure out, but there's a lot of conflicting data out there with respect to what the most satiating foods are. And from one end of it, we can talk about it sort of physiologically. So foods actually that are high in fat tend to actually be more satiating. Sort of the calories you get from fat tend to fill you up more and keep you feeling full for longer. You know, foods that are also high in fiber and high in protein. So nuts, in fact, are great from that perspective because they're fat, protein, carbohydrate, roughage, and so on. But so that's something from the point of view of like specific foods, although that also depends on past experience, because if, for instance, you don't eat a lot of nuts and you don't have a sense of from your past experience that nuts could be filling or not, you could actually eat way more nuts than you would, quote unquote, need to eat to get that feeling of satiation if you had more experience with them. And that leads us to one of the key components of our feelings of satiation and fullness comes from actually our past experiences. So the foods we're most familiar with and foods that we eat to say to ourselves, okay, now I'm finished the meal. I had that, you know, slice of bread, and I always have a slice of bread with dinner. If I don't have that slice of bread, I feel like I'm not, you know, finished or full. Or whatever that happens to be in your diet. A lot of it goes back to what we're used to eating, when we're used to eating it, and that being a sort of signal to ourselves psychologically that the meal is done and now you feel full.
It's a conditioning kind of thing. It's like this is the apostrophe or the punctuation mark to your meal.
Exactly, exactly. And so what's very interesting about that is often when people eat foods that they're not familiar with, so let's say you go out to some ethnic restaurant in a cuisine you've never had before, you could end up eating, you know, people also, that is to say, if you're not really paying attention to your stomach is hurting and you feel so full, but like eating a lot more of that food than you might normally eat because you don't know what it feels like to kind of be done with the meal.
I just had that experience because I'm generally gluten-free, casein-free, but for Yom Kippur, I fasted, and the custom is to have a break fast where bagels and lox and all manner of cream cheese are served, and, well, I was pretty hungry, and I didn't know my limits, so I guess I kind of overdid it a little bit. So I can well, relate to what you're just saying there. When it comes to, you actually coin a phrase here, which is DWD, dining while distracted. You know what about, you know, DWI, driving while intoxicated, but DWD, dining while distracted, is that part of the problem when it comes to when we put the feed bag on and don't know when to stop?
That is a huge problem, and especially in today's world where we're, you know, subject to weapons of mass distraction in the palm of our hand all the time by our cell phones, and we're constantly engaged in multitasking and doing other things while eating at the same time. and watching TV, you know, sitting down to dinner with the family around the table mm-hmm. has unfortunately become much less of the natural course of family affairs. And so often these days, people are doing multiple different things. The family's not together. And also, people are in a rush. But then, you know, when you have a few minutes to relax and you sit down and you have the television on or whatever else, what happens when you're paying attention to something else while eating is that you don't, first of all, notice whether you're full or not. Secondly, you don't even notice how much you're eating. And this is particularly insidious if forgetting about having, you know, sort of the plate of food in front of you where you know how much went on in the first place. But if you have that bag of potato chips or the bowl of whatever, you can be just sort of mindlessly sticking your hand into that and eating while doing something else and not realize that you've finished the entire bag or bowl until you look down and you see it. And so distraction and television watching in particular has been shown to be not such a good combination for watching your weight,
It's sort of the opposite of mindfulness, you know, mindful eating. And that's actually a strategy that sometimes they try to employ when they try to teach people better eating habits is to, you know, savor the food, taste the food, you know, slow eating, attend to what you're doing. Don't, have a sort of a single-minded approach to eating.
Exactly. And so this, you know, dining while distracted is the exact opposite. And not only are you not getting, you know, you're not realizing what you're doing, but like what you just said, you're not actually getting the pleasure that you would, that if you were paying attention to the food, you would realize, wow, this tastes really good. Or maybe after the 10th bite of whatever it is, you're like, you know what, I'm realizing that now it's not quite so delightful and I feel actually that I've had enough of this, and so you would stop if you were paying attention. But if you're not paying attention, then it's sort of the habit of the action takes over and you end up eating a lot more than you may have intended to.
You know, a lot has been made of portion size, and there's a guy who I've interviewed in the past, Brian Wanzink, mm-hmm. up at Cornell. I guess he's had some issues with shall we say, a challenge to his research bona fides. But nonetheless, you know, he's really underscored the point that the portion size sometimes guides our choices.
Yeah, so Brian Wanzig's work, you know, there may be some issues with replicability and so forth, but I think many of the basic premises of what he talks about are real in terms of, you know, the ecology and in the environment of, in which we eat. And portion size is a great example, and also the size of the plate and the way that the food on the plate fills that said plate, mm-hmm. depending upon how big that plate is. Obviously, if you have a big plate, you need more food to fill it. But we use plates as a guide to sort of what's the amount I'm supposed to be eating. And when you have giant plates filled to the brim, then you're going to be consuming a lot more food. Whereas, let's say you had a small plate filled to the brim, you would feel like, oh, that's, you know, it's a full plate. That feels good to eat. I like it when I see a full plate. But if you put that same amount of food on a large plate, you're going to feel disappointed that you're not getting, right. you know, enough, or especially when we go out to eat and we're thinking, how much does this cost? I think I should get more food, and so on. And so plate size and portion size are really critical into going into how we evaluate the amount of food we're eating and whether or not we're satisfied from eating it. And so smaller plates filled up is the way to go.
Does alcohol make us eat more, or does it in some ways attenuate our appetite?
Well, that all depends on how much of a drinker you are,
okay.
and also when you're drinking. So there's definitely, so the word apéritif, that is sort of like an appetite stimulator, that's where that comes from in French. Mm. And so having that drink before dinner is supposed to, in fact, sort of rev you up for wanting to eat the meal that you are going to then be served. And if you are not much of a drinker and you tend to drink with food, because of the fact, first of all, alcohol has calories, and also because it has that, you know, desire for food capability, so that aperitif quality, you can end up eating more with alcohol, plus you have the alcohol calories. But if you're someone who's used to drinking, especially with meals, it can also be something that moderates your intake, because you have that, your body knows it's getting some calories from the wine, let's say, and also because it can have components to it which either complement how you're mm-hmm. consuming food or otherwise make you
offer
feel
you some
more
of the gratification
satisfied.
That you'd otherwise have to get from sugar or, you know, a fancy dessert.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting, too, that if you ever were attending an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know, the presence of sugary snacks is very part of that.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually part of a sort of replacement for the calorie, the sugar, and the sort of pleasure that you get from alcohol. You can get that pleasure and the sugar calories also from donuts.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of sort of the new conception of AA is that, yeah, that's the next thing you need to tackle. I mean, tackle the alcohol, but then you're left with that hungry part of your brain that you got to work on when it comes to sweets. So in terms of another food that's super appealing, chocolate, and you mentioned bacon, of course, earlier, but what is it about chocolate that's just so compelling for people?
So chocolate is a food that combines sweetness plus fat. So there in itself is delicious. And then also depending upon whether or not you like dark chocolate, that's less sweet but also highly fat and maybe even a little bit of bitterness. So depending on how you like it. But chocolate, in addition to having, you know, wonderful melting in your mouth potential because of the way the fat and the sort of melts basically at perfect body temperature. So putting a piece of chocolate in your mouth and just letting nature take its course, it'll melt in this really wonderful way. So you get all the delightful, rich, unctuous qualities of it along with the sweetness that's going along with it. And, but in addition to that, it also has a couple of chemicals in it that have potential for increasing, you know, neurotransmitters and pleasure. One of the things that it contains is theobromide, which is a chemical cousin of caffeine. So it kind of revs you up from the point of view of sort of a stimulant effect. Mm-hmm. It also contains a chemical that's a chemical cousin of THC. Mm. So it can have a kind of a positive feeling from that perspective. And it triggers a sort of constellation of neural activity that depending on who you're looking at or the experiment can look like you're in love. So basically,
limerence,
it's
triggering, I think, is the term that's been used for that. Limerence.
Yep. So basically, you know, your brain on chocolate and your brain in love look a lot alike, and it feels really good, and the endorphins that are released and the other chemicals that are involved make it something that, you know, a highly pleasurable food. Now, that being said, you know, eating a Snickers bar or whatever the case might be, you're not necessarily getting the concentrations of the chemicals that might be producing these effects are going to be really quite low, especially because it's not just chocolate, it's mixed with other things, and, you know, you're not your high-end, you know, very chocolate-concentrated chocolate component there. But you can still get the pleasure from the sweetness and so forth. So eating sweet, going back to the beginning, really is something that's going to make you feel good temporarily. And it'll also make you feel a little happier and nicer temporarily.
So, you know, given all this, physiology, our hardwiring, and our evolutionary adaptation to try and score as many calories as we can. What are just a couple of take-home messages for listeners who are trying to, you know, put a lasso around their impulses?
So a few things that the motivation I had for writing this book was to really sort of give people the power over their relationship with food so that they could feel that they were in control of what they were doing when it came to eating rather than feeling that food was controlling them. And the way that I've tried to do this is by explaining all the ways, we haven't even really gotten into very many of all the psychological factors or the social factors that go into our experience with food. Mm-hmm. But we've talked about some of the environmental ones like television and some of the things that are just part of the food themselves. But just knowing these things, I think, can really help us manage our relationship with food and build a happier and healthier relationship. But secondly, just as sort of a basic premise, in addition to sort of the kind of common sense things that people probably already know, I like to underscore the idea of moderation and variation. And I don't want anyone to feel like they're depriving themselves. You know, diets are the worst possible thing for losing weight, because even if you lose weight temporarily, almost everybody gains it back with interest. But if you can think about, okay, I'm not going to restrict myself from something, but I'm not going to have a ton of it. And if I eat more slowly and with more attention, I'm going to experience more pleasure, and I'm going to take stock of what that pleasure is that I'm getting, and I'm going to know when I'm not getting it any longer. And then in terms of variation, no, we shouldn't only be eating kale and grapefruit. You know, you need to have a varied diet in order to get the most from the macronutrients that are around you. So even from the point of view of being healthy, you don't want to only stick to a small domain of food types. So, you know, things like the Mediterranean diet, I think, are really great because they have a very large variety, especially of fruits and vegetables, but also from the point of view of where you get your protein sources. If you are someone who is able to eat any kind of protein, I would say, you know, it's great. Do that from tofu to fish to meats, you know, but nothing necessarily too much. And I think that that's just kind of the best way of approaching food.
Okay. Well, the book is wonderful. You know, anything you write is wonderful. You know, from your very first book, The Scent of Desire, to the book That's Disgusting, and now your crowning achievement, Why You Eat What You Eat. You have a great way of translating very highfalutin scientific concepts into a parlance that's interesting and understandable. And, you know, once again, it's Why You Eat What You Eat, the science behind a relationship with food. Dr. Hertz, is there a website where people can get more information?
Sure, yes. My personal website is rachelhers.com, and you can find my book anywhere, I believe. Just type it into Google. But yes, and any questions anyone might have, you can try to contact me through my website, and I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, can we make this a freshman course mandatory for every college freshman so that, you know, they, or maybe in high school, because it would have been so important to learn these things, because these are basic tools that you need for living, to understand our physiology.
Well, I'm so glad that you said that, because I'm actually working on a kids' version of this book right now, especially the senses part of it. So, and for young kids, you know, that middle school age level, so they can have an understanding of what they're eating and hopefully learn some healthier relationship habits with food and so on.
It's a great counterforce to all the propaganda and all the lure of food advertising that they're exposed to. We need at least equal time and a bit of a counterforce to our toxic food environment, which constantly is enticing us to eat more and more junk. So thank you for that. You're on a mission.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. That was Dr. Rachel Hertz, Why You Eat What You Eat. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I'm inviting you to browse my online supplement dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. We stock only the highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements I prescribe to my patients and take myself. My specially curated professional-grade supplements are fulfilled via the FullScript network. FullScript is the safest and most convenient way to purchase my medical-grade supplements. Buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and offers world-class support. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free FullScript account. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com.